This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello once again, football fans, and welcome to the Historically Speaking NFL Matchups for Week 2 in this young NFL season. I'm Dana Augusta, your host, and in case you're new here, we take a look at matchups from this week's NFL schedule that are rematches of famous games from NFL history, and talk about them in a brief episode to not only reminisce, but to get you ready for the upcoming week in the National Football League. In this week's historical rematch episode, we'll talk about one of the most exciting Super Bowls in recent memory that came down to a crucial decision in the final seconds that determined who hoisted the Lombardi Trophy. We'll also look back on a game that is considered one of the biggest playoff upsets in a decade of the 1980s. And lastly, a playoff game from the 1970s that introduced the NFL to one of the most consequential home field advantages in the NFL in this team's first ever playoff win. That is what's going on here in this NFL Historical Matchups for Week 2 edition of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, where we talk about the best of sports from back in the day. On February 1st, 2015, the defending Super Bowl champion Seattle Seahawks were looking to become the first team since the 2004 New England Patriots to win back-to-back Super Bowls. Yet standing in the way of the 12-4 Seahawks was the 12-4 New England Patriots. At this time, I would like to evoke the great 20th century philosopher Ric Flair when he said, "In order to beat a man, you have to beat the man." Now, while the Seahawks were looking to go back-to-back, the Patriots were in the Super Bowl for the first time in 10 seasons, making their 8th Super Bowl appearance, tying them with the Dallas Cowboys and the Pittsburgh Steelers in their 6th under head coach Bill Belichick and quarterback Tom Brady. The game, of course, would become an instant classic. So good, in fact, that the game, which was one of the most watched programs in television history, was ranked 8th on the NFL.com's 100 Greatest Games and the 3rd highest Super Bowl game. The game was kept within one possession margin until the Seahawks took a 10-point lead late in the third quarter. The Patriots responded by scoring 14 unanswered points during the fourth to take a 28-24 lead with just 2 minutes remaining. On the final drive, the Seahawks got the ball on their own 20-yard line. Quarterback Russell Wilson of Seattle started the drive with a 31-yard completion to running back Marshawn Lynch. After a pair of incompletions, Wilson connected with Ricardo Lockett for an 11-yard gain and a first down. On the next play, Wilson threw a deep pass down the right sideline to Jermaine Kearse, who was covered by Patriots defensive back Malcolm Butler. Both players dove for the ball. Butler managed to deflect it with one hand, but the pass fell right into the hands of Kearse, who tipped it to himself and caught it while lying on his back. Butler realized what happened, and as Kearse was getting up for additional yardage, he was shoved and the Seahawks receiver out of bounds. The play gained 33 yards, and that set up a first and goal at the Patriot 5-yard line. On the next play, Wilson handed the ball to Lynch and gained 4 yards to the Patriot 1. With the clock ticking, Seattle coach Pete Carroll decided to, I guess, catch the Patriots off guard and pass the ball into the end zone. The play was designed for Kurtz to run a pick play on the right side to draw defensive backs away from Lockett as he would run a slant over the middle. However, Patriot defensive back Brandon Browner blocked Kurtz at the line of scrimmage, preventing him from picking Butler. For a split second, Lockett was open as he crossed the goal line, but before Wilson's pass found the mark, it was intercepted by Malcolm Butler, securing the four-point Patriot win. Butler's interception is regarded as one of the greatest plays in NFL history, and in relation to Super Bowl win probability, it is analytically the most important single play in NFL history. In contrast, Seattle's decision to pass instead of running the ball is considered one of the worst calls of all time. Brady, who set Super Bowl record for completions at 37, was named the game's most valuable player for the third time, tying the record held by Joe Montana. 2 years later, Brady would surpass both in Super Bowl 51. Speaking of Joe Montana, the San Francisco 49ers were named the team of the 80s by winning four Super Bowls during that decade of excess. After winning two world championships in 1981 and 1984 respectively, the Niners, 13-2 on the strike-shortened season of 1987, were once again primed for another Super Bowl run. Yet on the afternoon of Saturday, January 9, 1988, the Minnesota Vikings, fresh off of a 44-10 beatdown of the New Orleans Saints, were looking to get one step closer to Super Bowl 22. On a muddy, misty day at Candlestick Park, the Vikings behind receiver Anthony Carter's postseason record 227 yards and receiving on only 10 catches, defeated the top-seeded 49ers 36-24 in one of the biggest postseason upsets of the decade. Minnesota drove 77 yards on their opening drive, which included an 11-yard run by quarterback Wade Wilson. That led to a Chuck Nelson 21-yard field goal. Then, after an exchange of punts, Montana completed passes to Roger Craig and John Taylor for gains of 18 and 33 yards respectively, which led to a 34-yard field goal by kicker Ray Worthing. Then Minnesota broke the game open, scoring 17 unanswered points in the second quarter. Wilson led the Vikings to their first score in the quarter with on a 70-yard drive that included a pair of completions to Anthony Carter. The drive reached pay dirt when Wilson found tight end Carl Hilton on a 7-yard touchdown. After a 49ers punt, Wilson found Carter on a 63-yard completion, setting up a second Nelson field goal, increasing the Vikings' lead to 13-3. Then safety Reggie Rutland intercepted a pass from Montana intended for Dwight Clark and returned it 45 yards for a touchdown. The Niners had a chance to cut the lead before halftime, but Worthing missed a 26-yard field goal attempt and the score will remain 20-3. In the third quarter, 49ers safety Jeff Fuller returned an interception 48 yards for a touchdown early in the quarter, but the Vikings stormed right back. The series began with Carter gaining 30 yards on an end-around play as the team drove 68 yards to score on Wilson's short touchdown pass to Hassan Jones, making the score 27-10. Later on, San Francisco coach Bill Walsh would replace the struggling Montana with Steve Young. The decision appeared to pay off as Young hooked up with Craig for a 31-yard completion and later took the ball into the end zone himself on a 5-yard run, cutting their deficit to 27-17. But Minnesota countered with Wilson's 40-yard completion once again to that guy, Anthony Carter, that set up Nelson's third field goal of the day. Worthing missed a 48-yard field goal on San Francisco's next drive, and the team would go into the final quarter still trailing 30-17. In the fourth, Fuller was nailed with a 15-yard face mask penalty while tackling Vikings running back Allen Rice after he gained 19 yards on the screen pass. That would set up Chuck Nelson once again, 46-yard field goal to put the Vikings up 33-17. On the next San Francisco possession, Carl Lee intercepted a pass from Young, allowing Minnesota to run more time off the clock. Following a Vikings punt, Young led the 49ers on a 68-yard touchdown drive, which ended on a 16-yard touchdown pass to tight end John Frank. But by then, there was only 3 minutes and 42 seconds left in the game. Nelson later kicked a postseason record 5th field goal, this one from 23 yards out, to completely dash any hope of a miracle comeback. In addition to his 227 receiving yards, Carter had a 30-yard carry and returned 2 punts for 21 yards. Wilson completed 20 of 34 passes for 298 yards and 2 touchdowns with 1 interception. Nelson finished the day a perfect 5-for-5 on field goals, a notable contrast to his lowly 13 of 24 performance during the regular season. Montana was held to just 12 of 26 completions for 109 yards with 1 interception. Young, on the other hand, had a solid performance, 12 of 17 for 158 yards and a touchdown with 1 interception, while also leading the 49ers in rushing with 72 yards on 6 carries. This was just the 2nd postseason meeting between the Vikings and 49ers, as the 49ers won their only previous meeting in 1970. The Vikings would go on to lose the next week in the NFC Championship game to the Washington Redskins at RFK. The season of 1977 will be forever remembered as the season of Broncomania. After 18 seasons, the Denver Broncos, led by first-year head coach Red Miller, not only made the playoffs for the first time in team history, but they also had won the division for the first time and had home field advantage throughout the playoffs, which was really huge considering fans and teams had no idea what a home field advantage Mile High Stadium would become in subsequent years. But this was the first ever postseason game in Denver. And on this Christmas Eve afternoon, the Broncos would face the big bad Pittsburgh Steelers, winners of 2 of the last 3 Super Bowls. Incidentally, this game was on the same day as the famous Colts-Raiders divisional playoff game known as the Ghost to the Post Double Overtime Classic. The offense was led by veteran quarterback Craig Morton and veteran receivers Haven Moses and Rick Upchurch, but the calling card for this team was a defense known as the Orange Crush. And even though the Broncos were in their first ever playoff game, they didn't show it. Denver scored first as they were set up by John Schultz blocked punt and a Rick Ingles recovery at the Steelers 17. That set up a Rob Lytle 7-yard touchdown run. Trailing 7-0, the Steelers mounted a 56-yard touchdown drive that was highlighted by Benny Cunningham's 19-yard reception on a 4th-and-1 call. Steeler quarterback Terry Bradshaw would end up scoring with a 1-yard touchdown run to tie the game at 7 apiece. In the second quarter, Broncos defensive tackle Lyle Alzado forced a fumble from Franco Harris, which linebacker Randy Gradishaw recovered and returned 5 yards before fumbling himself. The second fumble was recovered by Tom Jackson. Yes, that Tom Jackson from ESPN. And we hear more about him a little bit later on. He returned it 25 yards to the Pittsburgh 10. On the next play, running back Otis Armstrong ran the ball into the end zone to give the Broncos a 14-7 lead. However, Pittsburgh quickly struck back, starting with Jim Smith's 28-yard kickoff return to the Steelers' 34. Bradshaw then hit John Stallworth for a 21-yard completion, and Harris ripped off a 20-yard burst before he finished the drive with a 1-yard touchdown run to tie the game at 14 with a minute 41 left in a half. In the third quarter, the Broncos extended their lead when Craig Morton found tight end Riley Odoms on a 30-yard touchdown pass. Early in the fourth, Pittsburgh managed to tie the game once again with a 48-yard catch by Stallworth setting up Bradshaw's 1-yard touchdown pass to tight end Larry Brown. But this would be the last score as Denver would soon take over the game. First, Jim Turner put the Broncos back up 24-21 by kicking a 44-yard field goal with 7:17 left on the clock. Then, Tom Jackson intercepted a pass from Bradshaw and returned it 32 yards to the Steelers' 9, setting up Turner's 24-yard field goal to make the score 27-21. On Pittsburgh's ensuing drive, Jackson struck again, intercepting another pass and returning it 17 yards to the Steelers' 33. But rather than sitting on their one score lead and trying to run out the clock with running plays, Denver took to the air, scoring the game-clinching touchdown on Craig Morton's 34-yard touchdown completion to Jack Dobbin with 1 minute and 44 seconds left in the game. Morton finished the game going 11 of 23 for 167 yards and a pair of touchdowns with no picks. But the star of the game was linebacker Tom Jackson. His two interceptions and a fumble recovery set up 17 Bronco points, 10 of them in the fourth quarter, as the Broncos defeated the Steelers for the first playoff win in their 18-year history. And that would do it for the Week 2 edition of the Historically Speaking NFL Matchups. We will try to come out with one of these mini episodes every week during the NFL regular season, highlighting the great and memorable games from the long history of the National Football League. As usual, this podcast comes to you from the Bill King Memorial Studio in the sports wing of TM4 Enterprises, located in suburban Atlanta in the shadow of Stone Mountain. To get more content of the Historically Speaking Sports, you can check us out on Twitter, X, at HistoricallySPT2, or you can send us a line at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. And if you have not done so already, please subscribe to the show. Tell your family, tell your friends, tell your neighbors. Heck, tell a passerby on the street about us if you think they like sports history. And until the next episode, stay blessed, stay cool, and be your best in everything that you do. It'll make the world a much, much better place. Peace out.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you got to do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.